Talk Radio 790 KBC, Peter to Linda 10 continues hour number two, brought to you by Larry Miller and Sit and Sleep. He'll, of course, beat anyone's advertised price, or your mattress is free. Coming up, going to give you a chance very shortly to win tickets to go see Roger Waters, one of the most amazing shows. I saw previews. My gosh, the Us and Them tour. Stunning. It's going to be at Staples Center, and you can win tickets if you play the Peter Tillman News Quiz when I tell you to call in. But first, a bunch of legal issues, and I want to run them by Royal Oaks, KBC News legal analyst. Good morning, Royal.
Hey, good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing okay. So what do you want to start with? You pick it, Cosby or Sessions?
Oh, let's go Cosby.
All right, so Cosby, I got a lot of emails, and I addressed it last hour. I want to see if I said the right thing. How come the defense rested in 6 minutes, and the prosecution called witnesses and witnesses and witnesses, and it lasted for days? And my sense was a couple of things. Number one, the defense did a good job in the cross-examine, and it is up. The burden is on the accuser. So if you feel you did a good job, shut up, because you don't want to introduce new stuff into the case that you don't have to bring in if you're feeling pretty confident about it. The other thing is, and I said the defense has been fighting the entire time, but he apologized in his closing for actually getting emotional. But the fact that the only witness he called was somebody from 2005, the detective there, and then the jury during deliberations asked about that 2005 interview, and it was read to them, indicates to me that they're looking at maybe some inconsistencies in the testimony between what she said in 2005 now, which would lead me to believe, and I know you never bet on these things, that Cosby could get an acquittal. It's taken a longer time than you would think if it was a slam dunk, number one. Now, true, they could be arguing about one point. But what is your take on that? Does that seem solid to you, or am I out of my mind?
No, you're making some good points there. I guess the first place to start is, of course, the big question of, you know, should Bill Cosby have testified? Now, if he's found guilty, of course, everybody will say, oh, 2020 hindsight, he should have testified. But we don't know what's going on in the jurors' minds. And so that was the big call. And you know, almost always in these high profile cases, that's the call that the famous person and their defense lawyers make. It's too risky to expose Bill Cosby. Now, you have some built-in resentment because jurors want to hear from the guy who's on trial, the famous person. And so you have to put up with the risk of the resentment, but the risk is too great. Now, here, as we've seen in some other cases, Conrad Murray and so on, there's sort of a surrogate testimony because they did hear from Cosby in the form of his deposition testimony, statements to cops. And so the defense was able to say, well, at least Cosby has put forth his side in a way, in a not a very friendly environment, but that makes it easier to say, no, Bill Cosby. Okay, so that's the first issue. Then the second issue you raise, what's the jury up to? You never know how much to read into the tea leaves in terms of the questions. Sometimes there's one wacky outlier juror who's asking, you know, the judge, peppering the judge with a bunch of questions that isn't representative of anybody else on the jury, because all you need is one person to ask a question. Other times, it's the consensus. The entire jury is interested. So we don't know, but as you say, they're focusing on some testimony that might be good for Bill Cosby because they're talking about, you know, what about inconsistencies by the accuser that were revealed in her various stories to the cops. The problem with the questions, Peter, is that the early questions out of the jury the last day or two focused on Bill Cosby talking about, oh, these pills are your friends and they're big pills and what color were they? That says to me maybe it's bad news for the defense, because if the jury is fussing over the details of the pills and what he said and what happened, it's less likely that the big picture for the jury is, okay, they had a consensual relationship. He maybe gave her some pills to relax, but the bottom line is they were getting it on, and she waited a year to report anything. And during that year, she placed 53 phone calls to this guy, and she and her parents went up to Toronto to see him at the concert. They brought a T-shirt for a gift. What kind of sex abuse victim behaves that way? Now, that's where you get the expert testimony in, and the prosecution put on an expert saying, well, people behave in weird ways. They want to forget. They try to forget by repressing it or acting like it's normal. You know, that could set off alarms in the jury. Bottom line is we don't really know. But I'll say this, Peter. If you had to predict, I would say it wouldn't be out of line to predict they were going to continue to struggle and maybe even be hung for this reason. On the one hand, you have America's dad. Everybody loved him and admired him. On the other hand, you have it sunk into the American psyche. This guy is a serial sexual abuser with 40 or 50 women saying essentially the same thing. He's drugging them. So how do you reconcile that? And when you have 12 people bust in from Western Pennsylvania and stuck in a hotel sequestered, a la the O.J. Simpson jury, how do you get all 12 of them to agree when half of them may think he was a hero and half of them may think, oh, my gosh, this guy is a horror show? So that could make it tough for them all 12 to agree.
Well, and what's interesting, too, to your point, the detective, when he was cross-examined, said that she did not, Constant didn't reveal to him or the other officer that she had other incidents of intimate contact with Cosby, which could be a sticking point. So you're right. It's not that easy. I said, it feels like it could be an acquittal to me. You're saying potentially hung. It is interesting that they're taking this much time. Don't know when they're going to come back. And they're not supposed to enter all that other information, Royal. You know, that's why we brought him from Pittsburgh, because they don't watch the news in Pittsburgh.
Right. Exactly. That's the hope. That's the goal. But, you know, it's so unrealistic because everybody followed the whole O.J., the Cosby thing, and they admitted in the jury selection process that, yeah, they were generally familiar with the publicity, but they were willing to set that aside. And that's all you can do. You can't get people who have been living in a cave and had not heard anything about Bill Cosby being accused of this.
The other thing that you just did, damn it, Royal, is you just had me think, where is Conrad Murray today? I miss him so much.
I think he's out of jail. I don't know if he's practicing medicine, but we'll have to track him down.
All right, let me play a short clip from Jeff Sessions, and let's talk about that testimony a bit and other legal issues as it pertains to the administration right now, because it's kind of fascinating what went down. Listen to what Jeff Sessions said in his opening.
The suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
Well, two things. Number one, I want to start talking like that, because as soon as I go down south, I want meat plus three and some sweet tea, because it's such a strong accent. But the other thing is, it was an interesting opening statement, but nobody was accusing him of that. They were saying you met with this Russian, and you didn't represent that you met with him. The other thing that was kind of interesting, and you tell me about this, is that the story that we heard, the first story we heard about why Donald Trump was fired, came because Sessions and supposedly Rod Rosenstein both were unhappy with how Comey handled the Hillary Clinton email investigation. That was ostensibly right. what it was. That's why I fired him. That's why I suggested it. Okay, so then Trump goes on with Lester Holt and said he was planning on firing him all along, which undercuts that. And that he said, he brings it to the Russia thing, saying the Russia thing with Trump and it was a made-up story. It's an excuse by Democrats. So completely undercuts that. Sessions' testimony ignored completely what Trump said in that interview to Lester Holt, and just stuck with the premise that it was because of Hillary Clinton, because if he does that and recommitted to the Hillary Clinton email thing, then he could defend himself and his recusal pledge. Do you agree? I mean, that was kind of an interesting thing, an interesting tact that he took. It's smart, because most people said he came off okay, and there was just smoke, no fire. But I find that kind of interesting that the president himself said this is the reason why I fired the guy, and Sessions, the attorney general, saying, no, the reason was because, forget that, don't look over there, don't listen to what he said, it was because of this, and I recused myself on that, and I'm fine, and the recusal was solid. I didn't talk about firing him, because that would have been a bad thing if it had to do with Russia. It was because of Clinton. What do you think about that from a legal standpoint?
Well, I think you're right that Sessions had no choice, really, but to stay away from Trump's comments about Russia being a motivating factor. For one thing, you know, that's Trump and his admissions and his state of mind. That's not what Sessions knew or what Sessions did. So Sessions really couldn't go there, even if he wanted to. But he didn't really want to because, as you say, he wants to shift the focus back to, I and Rod Rosenstein worked together. We wrote these letters. We thought Comey really messed things up in 2016 on the Hillary Clinton front. That's why we recommended that he be fired. So that's in his interest. I thought the emotion that he showed was interesting. It actually brought back an old memory from the early 90s when Clarence Thomas was going through his confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court, and he was accused of sexual harassment by Anita Hill. He turned it around in one flash, one moment, when he angrily said to the senators, This is a high-tech lynching. You know, when blacks get uppity and want to achieve great things, people slap them down. It's a high-tech lynching. And that really caught fire. It resonated. And you don't usually get that kind of emotion at that high level with these super-duper jobs. And I think that was why this was a soundbite that everybody was going with in terms of Sessions. But, you know, Sessions had a lot of pressure on him because I think, you know, according to the reports, Trump really is down on him because Trump's attitude is, what do you mean recusing yourself? Okay, you were affiliated with the campaign, and the rules say that you can't run an investigation for the Justice Department if you had some connection with the campaign, but it wasn't all that clear you should have stepped aside. And the fact that he stepped aside allowed Rod Rosenstein to say, I'm appointing a special counsel in the form of this guy Mueller. And that, I think, is the real danger that Trump senses he's in, that Mueller, there's a bromance going on between Mueller and Comey. Mueller is going to dig his teeth in. And, you know, how many special prosecutors slash counsel in the last 30 years have you heard of who didn't actually prosecute people and get some scalps? So Trump knows he's in for a fight. And maybe that's why somebody was floating a trial balloon in the last couple of days about firing, you know, yeah. What if Trump fired him? Exactly.
We're going to have that guy on tomorrow, Chris Ruddy. By the way, as far as executive privilege, he didn't invoke it. But with Mueller, since you brought that up, the Trump and his attorneys are going to have to hand over documents. As far as executive privilege, legally, presidents have not been historically successful in blocking inquiries, correct?
Yeah, it's been spotty. You know, it's funny. Eisenhower first invoked it back when the Joe McCarthy folks were poking around trying to get documents and testimony from Eisenhower's people, and I came up with this idea. You know, this is a secret. The people who advise the president have to know that what they say is confidential. Then you go into the 70s with Nixon and the same deal. Nixon said, I can't give up the tapes. That's executive privilege. And the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged that, yeah, it's a real thing. Executive privilege is a concept that needs to be protected, but it isn't universal. And, for example, just like the attorney-client privilege, there's what they call the crime-fraud exception. If you're breaking the law, you can't use the attorney-client privilege as a shield. Similarly, with the executive privilege, I think what the senators and the courts are going to do is say, you know, it isn't always applicable, and it's going to be case by case as to whether Trump really has a right to protect either conversations or he'd have a weaker argument trying to protect documents floating around in the White House. So, yeah, it was weird. Everybody thought they were taken aback when Sessions says, oh, I'm not invoking executive privilege. That's for Trump own and to invoke. But I got to protect his right to do it. If I blab to you guys, I've blown his right to invoke executive privilege.
And as far as the tape issue, the House Intel Committee, they've asked the White House counsel by June 23rd to turn over any relevant materials. So they have to kind of say, tape, no tape. If there is a tape, here it is. Or can they fight that too, Royal?
Well, they can try to fight it. But, you know, like the Nixon deal, they go down that road, they're probably going to lose. They're probably going to have to hand it over. It's just so bizarre, Peter, the idea that there might even be tapes. I mean, that cryptic tweet by Trump a week or two ago about, you know, Comey better hope there aren't tapes. Talk about, you know, just kicking over a beehive. Huh. You just have to ask yourself what the guy's thinking.
Plus, with Maryland and the District of Columbia and now 200 other Democrats saying, you know what, we're filing this thing on the emollients clause in your businesses. Am I right in that Maryland and Dillon and the District of Columbia, with their filing of the lawsuit over his businesses, they could potentially get his tax returns? That could force him to reveal taxes, right?
Exactly. That's a possibility if the suit is allowed to go forward. A lot of people are saying maybe the suit will be tossed out because the right of a state like Maryland to sue the president for accepting foreign gifts, it's not all that clear. You have to be injured before you can sue, and their claim of injury might be a little tenuous. So it wouldn't be a shock if that gets tossed out. But if it stays in the court, you're right. He might be ordered to hand over his tax return.
So here's the last question, Royal, and it's a big one, and I know there are the legal scholars are weighing in on both sides, but Robert Mueller, as far as recusing himself, it is pretty interesting. Mueller is really close with Comey. I mean, for 15 years they've known each other, and there is a section, I understand, in the code, as far as the Attorney General and the Criminal Division, disqualifying yourself if any person or organization is involved with the conduct, employee, persons. I don't know the exact wording, but it seems to indicate that if you're that close, that and you're friends with somebody, it would be tough. It would the ethics rules would kind of get into this long-term relationship that that there could be a conflict of interest and that Mueller should recuse himself. On a level scale of 1 to 10, how real is that?
I don't think that that is going to fly. I think that if you have a personal connection, whether they're actually social friends, then Mueller, there might be an argument that he wouldn't be able to be objective, and so he couldn't prosecute or look into things having to do with Comey. But I think if you just have the professional connection, no matter how close, I mean, if they were super close, if they were just basically partners on a bunch of trials in the foxhole together, that's one thing. But if, as is the case, I think they simply were fellow members of the Justice Department over the years with different jobs, I don't think that that's going to lead to the recusal. Yeah, ironically, it's the same rule that Sessions was talking about yesterday. Basically, there's a rule that says you can't run the investigation of a campaign, for example, if you were involved in the campaign, as is the case where Sessions was a surrogate for the Trump campaign. And how can he run an investigation as to whether the Russians colluded with the campaign he was part of? So there was a legitimate basis for him to step aside. I don't really see Mueller having to step aside.
And do you think this new case with the 200 Democratic members of the House and Senate who are suing over Trump's foreign business ties, will that be thrown out, or is that something else that's going to drag on for years?
I guess it'll be tossed out because I think the government will file a motion to dismiss and say, Judge, they just don't have standing. It's too far-fetched, this notion that Maryland really was injured by Trump accepting, you know, some ceremonial gift or Trump's hotels making a bunch of money and thus the Maryland hotels can't compete. It seems like kind of a stretch. It just seems like there's so many bigger things on Trump's plate right now that he would have to worry about.
Got it. Well, I thank you, Royal. I know it was last minute. I really appreciate you coming on. RoyalOaks.com is the website, the Twitter at Royal Oaks, and we will wait and see the Cosby verdict and see who's right here. You're hung, and I mean that in a good way, and I'm acquittal, and we'll talk to you again soon, all right?
Take care.
Take it easy. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Here's what we're going to do. You're going to call because I know a lot of people want these Roger Waters tickets because it's just stupendous. If you go online and see the visuals that this guy puts together, there's no show like a Roger Waters Pink Floyd type show. And I know he's doing stuff from his new album, but doing 80% of the old Pink Floyd stuff too, and it's insane. So call now, 800-222-5222, if you want to play the news, because we're going to do that in a little bit. But next, going to talk to a fascinating gentleman, Mark Bowden, the author of more than a dozen books, who's most famous because they made into film Black Hawk Down, and his new one, is Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam. It is, don't zone out on Vietnam. There's something that relates to today as far as this battle, this huge battle, where generals refused to accept what was happening in this battle. The White House was getting information from these generals about what was happening in this battle. And what Mark Bowden does and why he's an award-winning author and why this is also going to be made into a series, a mini-series, is he gets into everybody's head. He talks to and interviews politicians, soldiers on both sides, citizens on both sides, and makes you feel like you are there. And it's really chilling. It's really a stunning book. He's a really interesting guy. So we're going to do that next. And again, the phone lines are lighting up. Get in quick for the Roger Waters tickets, 800-222-5222. And we'll do that right after we talk to Mark Bowden here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Talk Radio 790 KBC, Peter Tillman 10 continues with Mark Bowden. He's authored over a dozen books, including Black Hawk Down, to finish the killing of Osama bin Laden. And how do you pronounce it? Hue, 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. You know, and it's actually kind of a generational thing. I think people who are my age know it's Hue, and younger people probably want to say Hue.
Well, it looks like Hue, but it's Hue, and I made sure to look that up. First of all, 5 years. How do you commit to something for 5 years and have that kind of discipline to tell, I'm going to tell a story because it was pivotal and it was important, and I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I read reviews of your book, and there are so many colonels, sergeant, members of the military who were there who say, Mark got it. I've read about Vietnam. I served in Vietnam. But this book captures what I felt, what I smelled, the fear that I had. How do you do that, Mark?
Well, thank you for the compliment, Peter. I appreciate it. And, you know, it's just something I've been doing my whole adult life. You plunge into a project like this and you just start talking to people and listening to them and getting them to tell their stories, and over, you know, a period of time, in this case years, you accumulate, you know, like almost a mental mosaic from all these different accounts of what that experience was like. And frankly, the longer you do it, the more fascinating it becomes because you develop a deeper and deeper understanding.
And I guess it is. You're peeling the onion, and every question you get answered begs another question. If I can reverse engineer this before we dive into the story itself, it's pretty interesting because if you look at it from 30,000 feet, there's a big story there, a big narrative about the media and the public getting information from the media and trusting it in an age now where everybody's talking about fake news and we've got a really demarcated society. This could have been almost that turning point, not just the one battle that changed minds about Vietnam in 1968, but Walter Cronkite and the purpose of the news and news reporting and how it can impact a society.
Yeah. You know, and I think it is true that in the early 1960s, as a society, you know, America had enjoyed tremendous military success in World War II and even in Korea. And I think, you know, there was a tendency for the established networks and newspapers to kind of echo the official line. But the real reporters, the people who were putting themselves on the line, who were on the front where the fighting was taking place, you know, they had begun to tell a different story
right.
about Vietnam. And, you know, they were contemporaries in some cases with the young Marine captains who were commanding companies in the field. And, you know, they were hearing the real story from the people who were actually being shot at. And particularly as concerns the Battle of Hue, you know, they began to tell a story that was completely at odds with the official account.
Well, I got chills at some of the accounts. I haven't gotten through the whole book because I just got it. But you talk about a 20-year war that killed 3 million people, almost 60,000 of them U.S. soldiers. And the Tet Offensive, people maybe know that headline, but don't know what really went on and what the invasion was like. And you took us through it, like you said, from the perspective of reporters, photojournalists, people on both sides of the war. The one that blew me away and has been written about before, but maybe you can address it, is Carl DeLeo, the infantryman who was there, who had to dig in. These guys were left out for almost a day or to 2 days of getting shot at continuously and having mortars dropped on them. And the way that you portrayed it, I've never seen anything like it.
Thank you, Peter. You know, and Carl's story is just chilling. He's a young guy from New Jersey who was drafted and ended up in a cavalry unit. And they were sent out to essentially march from an outpost north of Hue toward the Citadel, which is the big fortress of the city, from the outside. And they marched straight into a huge Viet Cong, North Vietnamese position where they were vastly outnumbered. And they ended up trapped in this field, surrounded, and being mortared. And Carl described, you know, being in this foxhole and watching these mortars rise high in the sky. You could see them. And they would peak at a certain point and kind of freeze in the sky, and then they would plummet straight down. And if they hit where you were gone. Some of his friends in a foxhole nearby were, as he put it, plumed. They were just turned into a fine mist of pink and
That's
blood.
Okay. That's what got me. I teared up at that because you used the word vaporized, I think, that they were hit. He was watching his friends vaporized into a red mist, and I went, what 20-something survives that, seeing that, living through that? Unbelievable.
Well, I think that to understand war and to understand a battle, you really need to get inside the shoes of the people who are being shot at and killed and wounded and who are going through the ordeal. And I try to build these stories from the ground up as opposed to...
Oh, you do. You know what? What I was able to read so far, and I'm going to finish the book, is stunning in that, like I said, you give it a context, and I don't want to jump around, but like one of the things that blew my mind, I think is what you said, the Viet Cong traveled with sedated live pigs. They would carry live pigs sedated so they didn't make noise, and they would gut them and eat them while they were traveling. So that's how they had their nutrition. And you go, what? In what world does that exist?
Well, it's a world where you don't have big factories turning out meals ready to eat and packaging them and shipping them over in large planes for distribution. I mean, this was a society that was really at a very basic level. And it was funny because, you know, people in America who were in favor of the war would call for the United States to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age. And the truth is that this was a society that was not all that removed from a basic agricultural existence. And they had, you know, that this does not make them stupid, but they had their own way of, you know, feeding their troops in the field.
Amazing.
And it worked just fine.
I think you also mentioned that bombing them to the Stone Age doesn't work because the pilots who were bombing them said, we don't have targets. We bomb a bridge in a rural jungle area, and 2 days later, the bridge is back.
Right. Or a small factory. I mean, it's one thing if you have a big industrial state where you can take out electrical grids and you can destroy big bridges and you could take out rail lines and things like that. In Vietnam, I mean, people were living at a fairly subsistence level, so anything that you destroyed was usually something that could be rapidly rebuilt and replaced.
Unreal. So I've interviewed generals, and I always say, how do you sleep at night knowing that you study strategy and you think you know what you're doing, but you're sending boys out potentially to their death? And they said that, of course, is the nightmare of war. And Westmoreland, General Westmoreland, had this wrong. He thought that taking Hue was going to be an easy thing, that he didn't anticipate a lot of stuff, that people were gone for the holidays, number one. Number two, that the troops from the north could be rallied in those kind of numbers. He thought that they were not that organized, and they couldn't do urban fighting. They could only do jungle fighting, so he got that wrong. And three, the North Vietnamese thought wrongly that they could rally the troops in the south to come to their side once they got there. So it was a mess from every angle, correct?
It's true, and, you know, none of the theories actually played out the way that the generals anticipated. And that's war. I mean, I don't think you can fault someone for being mistaken or for failing to foresee
Sure. Everything
that will happen. That's just human. But what was really distressing to me is that after General Westmoreland was confronted with the truth, instead of saying, oh, I was wrong, and adapting his tactics, he insisted that he had been right all along. And he basically just denied what was happening right in front of his eyes. And as a result, a lot of young Americans got killed because they were being sent to attack far superior positions, well entrenched, and they didn't have a prayer. And the command in Saigon, which was Westmoreland's headquarters, simply wasn't listening.
Amazing. And explain, okay, if you could explain the offensive to me a little. First off, the fort that they attack is huge. You painted a picture. This is a square mile with 30 to 40-foot high walls, a palace basically inside it, royal palace, streets that look like neighborhoods, and a moat and an airfield.
Right.
So this is not a small area that they're going to now attack and change the face of the war, where they thought there's no way this place is ever going to be taken, and yet through miscalculations it was. How long was the planning from the north to take this, to get into the citadel?
Well, Hanoi made the decision in spring or summer of 1967, and for months they had actually already begun to position troops into South Vietnam, infiltrating North Vietnamese regulars down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They actually had begun doing that before they made the final decision to proceed. But they made the decision in the summer of 1967, and that was months before the battle started. They invaded Hue and about 100 other cities in South Vietnam on the eve of the Tet Offensive, which was January 31st of 1968.
Wow. And you talked to people involved in that. I think there was an 18-year-old girl. I remember the duck boat incident where they were smuggling arms in boats. Who coordinated? How did that get so coordinated? Because you look at villages, you look at people in the jungle, and you think, how did they incentivize these people? But they were fighting for their country. This was their survival, correct?
Right. Many of them were motivated more by the fight for independence than they were about communism or the kind of government that they would eventually have. And, you know, the truth is that the Vietnamese had been fighting for their independence for a long time. They
Right.
fought against the French.
Right.
The Viet Cong had then been called the Viet Minh. And there were remnants of those organizations, you know, that had been in place for many, many years. So the Hanoi government, working, you know, both through its own very experienced and professional army, had these Viet Cong brigades, which were also very experienced and well-organized. And they were recruiting, as you mentioned, you know, young people like J.T. Mung, the village girl you mentioned, who were totally committed to the cause. So this was not some spontaneously thrown together military offensive. This was a very sophisticated military operation that took many, many months to prepare for.
And they would come down and get young women to hang out at bars and hang out at bases, ostensibly to gather information, but they couldn't write anything down, so they had to memorize everything.
That's right. They would watch the comings and goings of men and weapons and vehicles and keep a mental tally because, I mean, there was a fairly strong South Vietnamese intelligence system at work in Hue, and, you know, to be standing on a street corner watching the gate to an American base and taking notes would have been too dangerous. So they memorized what they witnessed, and then every evening they would meet and report on what they'd seen.
Mark, you've done this. I mean, Black Hawk Down, all the books that you've written. Anything blow you away? Any of the interviews with these people that really stunned you, where you're sitting looking at somebody's eyes and you're getting to know the person and you're trying to understand what they felt and why they did something, but where you look in their eyes and you're seeing...
Peter, you know, when you do this kind of work. One that really stood out for me was an older Vietnamese man. His name is Nguyen Duc Quan. And when this battle happened, he was a young man. He was a devout Buddhist and a very idealistic person who essentially joined the Viet Cong after the South Vietnamese government had cracked down on Buddhists who opposed President Thieu's regime. And he, I think, was about as well-motivated as a human being can be. But over the course of the month that his troops held the city of Hue, they got caught up in a gory bloodletting, tracking down people who had worked for or allied themselves with the South Vietnamese government. And he ended up presiding over these purges, which, as he spoke to me about, you know, last year, you could see that he was still deeply haunted by what had happened. And it was the story of great idealism being perverted into something really ugly and terrible. And I think it's very difficult for him to accept that he was a part of that. And I just remember being very moved by his story and by how, you know, he's still haunted by it these many years later.
I can imagine. And we should say that after those in the South wouldn't be coerced, they marched 10,000 or more were killed. They were just purged, destroyed. It was, you're not coming aboard, see you later. Now, there was also another individual, Colonel Ernie Cheatham. His job was after this was taken, this ground was taken, and they lost it. He had to go in there, and I think you said it was block by block, house by house, try and take it back.
Ernie Cheatham, you know, was a real character. He had been a professional football player. He played for the Baltimore Colts and the Pittsburgh Steelers. He's a giant of a man. And when he was given the assignment of going into Hue and taking it back, unlike General Westmoreland, who already figured he knew everything, Ernie actually went and found the old Marine Corps manuals for how to fight in an urban environment. And he spent the whole night before he went in studying and trying to learn what he could from these manuals. The last time the Marines had fought a big urban battle was in Seoul, you know, many years before in Korea. And so when he arrived in Hue, he had adapted to the new and surprising circumstance of the city being taken. And he came with the weapons and tactics that he needed to take the city back.
And that leads us up to the Walter Cronkite time and Walter Cronkite's sense of being a war journalist that something was not right here and reporting it. The book is stunning. I can't wait to dive back in. The reporting is amazing. How did you get access? Did anybody turn you down, or was everybody willing to talk that you reached out to?
Everybody I reached out to was willing to talk. You know, American veterans who today are well organized because of the Internet. So it was not that hard to find them. And they love to tell these stories because they feel the country never fully understood what they went through and what the Vietnam War really was. And in Vietnam, I mean, they won the war. And so to them, you know, the victory over the Americans is a triumphant chapter in their national history. So while they're not always terribly willing to talk about the dark side, the purges that took place during the occupation of Hue, some of them were willing to talk about that, and all of them were willing to talk about how they got involved in the battle and, you know, what their role was in it and what they did. So, you know, this was kind of an ideal time for a journalist to go back and study it, because most of these people are still alive and their memories are still strong.
It must be mind-blowing to many of them that you, as you walk down the streets there and see tourists from all over the world with cameras taking pictures and charging stuff and eating lunch, and some having no concept of this battle, the bloodiest, possibly the one of the bloodiest battles ever fought and the turning point in the war. The book, Hue, 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam, which it actually was. The website is HUE1968.com. The book is available now. It's stunning. And I understand that Michael Mann is going to turn this into a series, an episodic thing, like a five-part special, correct?
That's the plan, Peter. I think it's going to be 10 parts, and I think he's making it for FX.
Wow. And are you involved when that happens? I'm assuming you're involved.
I am, yeah. I was actually very much involved in the creation of the movie version of Black Hawk Down. And I was told, you know, in this project, I'm a co-executive producer, and they warned me that I was going to actually have to work.
It doesn't sound
well,
like
I'm prepared.
Doesn't sound like you're work adverse. And you get to get out of Philadelphia for a little bit, I guess. Where will they film it? What do they use as a Vietnam?
I've talked to Michael, and I can't imagine him doing anything other than shooting in Vietnam.
I would think.
And it's very accessible. I would imagine that he would be able to do that now.
You're a mind-blowing writer, and the book is stunning. Mark Bowden, thanks for the time. Thanks for the book. Thanks for all of the books. Seriously, what's your next project?
Well, you know, I decided I'm not going to embark on one just yet, so I don't know. I've got some magazine work to do, and probably before the end of the year I'll light upon another book topic, but I'm not in a rush.
It sounds it. Well, thank you so much for this, and really, really digging deep writing about and it's a really significant time in our country's history that we should know about and lessons learned. Again, Hue, 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam, more than worth reading. You can also read him in The Atlantic. He's got some great articles in The Atlantic always. So thanks, Mark. Really appreciate it. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Let's do the quiz for tickets to Roger Waters, and let's go to Matt in L.A. Hey, Matt.
Hello.
All right, so you're lucky because we have limited time, so it's limited questions, but you know how this works. Multiple choice, true or false. Listen to me carefully, all right?
Got it.
Democratic lawmakers are suing Donald Trump over what? Version 2.0 of his travel ban executive order? Foreign business ties? Or his mystifying haircut and spray tan?
Emolument business ties?
Yeah, the business ties. You did good. Republican senators are considering keeping some Obamacare taxes. True or false? True or false?
True?
They're seriously considering keeping in place some Obamacare taxes for the longer-than-House-passed bill. Flag Day celebrates what? A, the day that Seamstress Betty Ross completed the first flag. B, the 1777 resolution, which called for an official United States flag. Or C, the birthday of George Washington. A, B, you got it, the 1777 resolution. And one more. Which of these historic events took place on June 14th? Falkland Islands Wars ended? Folk singer Burl Ives was born? Michael Jordan leads the Bulls? Or all of the above? All of the above. Yes, exactly right. You're going to go see Roger Waters, Us and Them tour. Congratulations, man. Stay on the line. We'll get your tickets. And Dr. Drew is next here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.